books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and as this year's Carnegie Medal interviews are flowing in, I thought I'd listen back to some previous winners. So today, we'll hear from Manon Stephen Ross, Joseph Coyle-Ho, and Tanya Lanman. A prize winner in its native Welsh, our first book on the Yotho Carnegie shortlist is The Blue Book of Nebo by Manon Stephen Ross.
She got this book from a house we broke into in Nebo. It was in one of the small drawers of a little desk in the corner of someone's living room. Usually we only steal the really important stuff, like matches or rat poison or books. But she held this notebook in her hands and turned it over a few times before putting it in her bag. "You have that," she said later, when we got home, "to write your story. The Blue Book of Nippa."
The Blue Book of Nippa is a novel about a mother and son surviving the end of the world, basically. There's some kind of unnamed nuclear disaster. And there's basically nobody else left around but them. And it's about their survival and about how they survive on a practical level, but also on an emotional level at that age where the son, Dylan, is naturally growing away from his mother, but there's nobody to grow towards because there's nobody left. So it's kind of about the end of the world, but it's also about a mother and son relationship.
And we never actually find out what happened, although there's a maybe a hint of a nuclear something.
Yeah. I think I wanted to keep it that way because on one level, it just made it easier for me on a practical level, you know, so because nobody really knows what would happen exactly in those kinds of situations. But also I wanted it to be transferable to different kinds of situations. And, you know, I wrote this book in 2017. And since then, I think we've become a lot more eco-conscious. I certainly am. I have a lot more eco and anxiety than I did. And I think maybe if I wrote this book now, I wouldn't have selected the nuclear option, if you like. It would be something else. But I do think it's easily transferable to different kinds of world events.
Yeah, because in the anyone who was born in the 70s or the 80s, the threat of nuclear war or nuclear accident was very real at the time.
Absolutely. And I think that's where this book comes from, really. I remember going to protest and things with my parents, CND, the campaign for nuclear disarmament when I was a child. And then that worries always stayed with me, that fear. And it kind of went away for a little bit when I was a teenager. And then it came back again when I had my own children. And there's a story that my sister remembers, but I can't remember it myself, but there was a sort of, there was a CND protest and then there was a speaker who'd come to take questions from the children specifically. And somebody had asked this speaker if there was some kind of accident in the nuclear power plant, Wylfa on Anglesey, what would it be like? And the answer was, think about how bad it could be. And it would be worse than that. And apparently I didn't sleep for days after that. Because to think that something is worse than your imagination can even come up with, it's just terrifying.
Now, you said this was written in 2017. So this was pre-COVID. This was a book about people self-isolating before we all had to.
Yeah. It was a weird one because I wrote it originally in Welsh and it came out in 2018 in Wales. And then COVID came along and it was a little bit uncomfortable because people were saying, oh, this is reminding me of Llyfr Glas Nebo, as it's called in Welsh. And I was thinking, oh, yeah, parts of it are just a bit too close for comfort. And especially in the early days when we didn't quite know what we were facing, and what was happening. So, yeah, it's quite a weird one that because it, I think it came out exactly the right time. And it was odd because there was a stage adaptation in Welsh by a company called Cwmni'r Franwen. And I remember on the last night, there was a Q&A after the performance, and I was part of the Q&A. And a few people were starting to not shake each other's hands because there was this COVID-19 thing. And I thought at the time, why is he not shaking my hands? This is just ridiculous. There's just nothing. There's nothing going to come of this COVID thing. Of course, I was proven completely wrong. But it was odd that, you know, I think if it would have happened just a little bit earlier, that theatre experience wouldn't have happened. And a lot of people who went to see it in the theatre said that was a really odd way of starting lockdowns, because the week before I'd seen this play about the end of the world and having to feel and be isolated.
Now, originally written in Welsh, as you said, did you translate it yourself?
I did, yeah, I did. I really love translation because I'm Welsh first language. So I was brought up speaking Welsh, and I speak Welsh at home with my own children as well. But English has always been there as well. So I've been fluent in both languages since I can remember. And I really enjoy the process of translation, or maybe adaptation is a better word for it when it comes to creative things. And so I adapted it into English when I didn't have any kind of hopes for it in a way. I just thought, well, I'll do it because it's something that I really enjoy doing. I'll do it just for my own pleasure. And I think that works really well with everything creative, because if you do it for yourself, there's something more authentic about it, and you're not doing it, you're not trying to please everybody, you're not writing for a particular audience. You're writing just for your own pleasure. I think there's something quite pure about doing it that way.
You said adapted. Does that mean it's a different book in the two languages?
Yeah, it is. Because in the Welsh language, it's written in the first person, from the perspective of the two characters, the mother and son. And of course, in the Welsh version, they were writing the Blue Book of Nepo in Welsh. And in the English version, I thought, well, I could either, you know, change the location completely into somewhere where they wouldn't speak Welsh, or I can keep it in the same place in Nepo. But then I have to come up with a reason why they're writing it in English. And so the theme of reclaiming your mother tongue and your own language isn't there so much in the English, in the Welsh version. It's more about people who speak Welsh and don't feel that their Welsh is good enough to write, and it's that kind of thing more in Welsh. So it does feel like quite a different book, and I did change most of the names between two versions. So Rowena is the same, but in the Welsh version, Dylan is Sean, Mona is Dwynwen, because I just wanted it to feel like a different book, I think. I wanted to give myself that license to change it so that it was the best book it could be and not feel too tied to the original. But the name changing didn't really work because I've just confused myself so many times in interviews and so on. I've just said the wrong name and then they don't know what I'm talking about.
So what's it like translating other people's work? Is it hard to keep your own slant away from it?
Absolutely. It's a lot more difficult translating someone else's creative work. I've translated quite a few of the Enid Blyton books from English into Welsh. And the most important thing is that the reader doesn't hear my voice. They have to hear Enid Blyton's voice. And it's really difficult to write in someone else's voice. So sometimes there would be a sentence that I would kind of, you know, my gut would take me this way, but I think, no, that's not the Enid Blyton way, so I have to go that way. And you kind of weirdly have to get into the head of the author. And also it makes you appreciate the art of other writers, because she wrote in a completely different way and style to what I do. But, you know, it's so clever the way she does it. And I don't think I could do that. I don't think I could mimic what she does, even though I've had to look at it really, really closely. It's really hard. It's an art. And I know that there are people far better than me at doing it, because I know that, you know, Nepo has been translated into other languages. And I think sometimes translators just don't get the praise that they deserve, because it's a really creative process and a really difficult one.
Yeah, I think the three people who will really read a book are the editor, the translator, and the audiobook narrator.
Absolutely.
The Welsh version is read by Morfydd Hughes, but you narrated the English version. How was that?
Oh, that was such an odd experience because, you know, I tend to move on from things quite quickly. So by the time that I'd gone in to record the Blue Book of Nepo in a studio, I hadn't actually read the book for a good couple of years. And I did it all in one day. And it was like looking at myself from afar, because there are parts of it and I thought I'd completely forgotten some bits. But it makes you examine yourself in a really uncomfortable way. I'm thinking, why did I write that? That's quite dark. Was I okay writing that? There's a lot of that sort of thing. But also, it's quite grounding. It takes you back, and it sort of, I really appreciated the opportunity to do that because it made me have a different kind of relationship with it after the fact, if you like. Because after a book comes out, quite often you can just go, well, that's gone and I'm never going to read that again. And you don't, you know, quite often there's no reason for you to go back and read anything. But it's always a good idea to do it, I think, because it's like reading your own diary years down the line.
Now, it's told in two voices, Dylan and Rowena, at least in the version I've heard. Was that planned, or did that happen organically when you were writing it?
It happened quite organically. I never plan anything. I have a very short attention span. So if I plan anything I'm writing, I get bored really quickly if I know what's happening at the end. So I tend to just put pen on paper and just see where it goes. I knew that I wanted to write something apocalyptic, and I'd always wanted to do that. But I'd written quite a few books before this one, and this was completely different for me, and I didn't know if people would like it. I thought it's not in my usual style. You know, usually I write quite long books, you know, 80,000 plus words, and this is, I think, 20,000, if that. And so it was really quite different. But once I started it, it just kind of went, and it was one of those really lovely experiences that happen sometimes when you write, is when your characters shock you. And there are a few instances where I remember thinking, I can't believe she's just done that, or I can't believe he's just written that down. And even now, you know, the absolute honour of being on the Carnegie shortlist, the main emotion and feeling I have, pretentious as it sounds, is I'm just really glad for the characters. I think, oh God, well, they would just love the fact that they're getting all this love. So the characters became so real to me, and they're still in that space. I still think of them as real people and not really people I've created.
How did you find trying to find the two voices when you were doing the audio version?
I think I found it quite natural. It didn't stress me out to do the audio version. I was an actor before I became a writer, and I think that helps. And also just the fact I have three children, and I've always read to them, and I think that is a great help as well, because there's no self-consciousness, you know, you're used to doing the voices basically. And I think they have quite distinct voices as characters, and I could only let myself be taken with the flow of their different styles and different voices, hopefully.
Now, as you say, it's up for the Justo Carnegie, so that basically means it's classified as a YA book in the rest of the UK. But in other territories, it's an adult book.
Yeah, yeah, it's really interesting. The original, so Llyfr Glas Nepo, the original, was a book that won the Literature Prize in the National Eisteddfod in Wales, which is a big cultural Welsh language festival. Happens every year. And I'd written it originally for young people, But they advised me that the publishers and the adjudicators of that competition advised me not to put the YA label on it, because to label it as anything would sort of take readers away and it would put adult readers off. And so, yeah, in Welsh, it's been published as a novel for adults. In the US, it's for adults. I think in Spain, Catalonia, Poland, and I think most other countries, and I think in French and English version in the UK is a YA. And in my heart, I have to say it, this, yeah, it's a YA book. I mostly read YA. That's what I love most. And it's the books from that period of my life that have had the biggest effect on me.
Just out of interest, taking the Polish version as an example, are they translating from English or Welsh?
Ah, the Polish version was translated from the Welsh, and the Catalan and Spanish were translated from the Welsh, and I think the rest have been translated from the English. But that means, of course, because I didn't expect any of this, you know, when I was translating it into English, that means that half of the books are the male lead characters, Dylan, and the other half is Sean. So, yeah, this has made it more complicated yet again. But it's quite a different book in Welsh. So the reaction is interesting, because I like to see, oh, what do people pick up on in these different countries? And, yeah, it's really fascinating for an author to write a book and then watch what happens with it and watch how it develops or how it doesn't.
Yeah, that's quite a niche market, trying to find a Catalonian Welsh speaker.
Yeah, he's fantastic. So, yeah, it's a really odd one. And, you know, I did a podcast recently where they introduced me to Emir, who translated it into Catalan. And it was a bit like meeting a long lost brother or something. Thinking, thank you so much for looking after my baby.
Now, quite near the studios we have in Glasgow is the Gaelic Book Council. Is there something similar in Wales?
Yeah, we've got a Welsh Books Council, and they're fantastic. So most of the publishing in Wales is partly government funded. Basically, you come up with an idea, you submit it to a publisher who then submits it to the Welsh Books Council, and then they decide whether they think it's worth going ahead with. And it's created a really lively literary scene in Wales. And it's really interesting, because it doesn't follow the Anglo-American trends. It's got its own thing going on. And that's true about Welsh music as well. And Welsh art, I think, generally, it doesn't follow trends as much as you'd expect it to. So yeah, the Welsh Books Council is great. They've been really, really fantastic support to me. And I know that, you know, I was mentioning the Eisteddfod, well, because I'm a Welsh speaker, I've had the privilege of being raised with the opportunities to take part in creative things my whole life. And to write a book in Welsh is, you know, you always have the opportunity to try in the Eisteddfod and to get your work assessed, if you like. It's almost like the process of sending a book out to an agent, I suppose, but you get to do all that for, I think, it costs a fiver to send in a whole novel, and you get three different adjudications. So it's brilliant. It's a really supportive community.
Now, you mentioned art there, and one thing we missed if we're downloading the book from RNIB is the cover. Can you give us a wee audio description of it?
Yeah, it's a blue cover, of course, and you can see the sea, you can see a mountain, and these are all in different shades of blue. And then there's a house, and there's a house with a lean-to, and there's a figure of a boy sitting on the roof of the lean-to. But in the original Welsh, the book was just a blue cover with the title Llyfr Glas Nebo written on it in a childish hand, and I'd got my son to write it down, and I said, can I just write Llyfr Glas Nebo down here? And he said, what for? And I said, that's something for work. And then the book came out, and I said, look what you've done this. So he keeps telling me now he deserves 10%.
The winner of the Carnegie Medal, along with everything else, is given a Braille copy of the winning book. Is it important that your book's translated into things like Braille and audio so it's accessible for all?
Absolutely. I think at the beginning of one's career, I think there's a tendency to just be so appreciative that we're published at all that we don't perhaps give enough attention to making sure that these things are available. I know that I think most of my books are available in Welsh as audiobooks, but I would just love to be to get my hands on a Braille copy. I just want it to be accessible to everyone. And I know with one play that I wrote that was available in Braille as well. And I remember getting the copy in my hands and you know, of course, not being able to read Braille. I couldn't understand it, but I was just so appreciative that someone had gone to the trouble of making it accessible. So yeah, it's really important. It's really important.
Marin Stephen Ross, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And moving on to another winner of the Carnegie Medal and former Children's Laureate, Joseph Coilhole. He talked to me about his prize-winning book, The Boy Lost in the Maze.
In ancient Greece, Theseus makes a dangerous and courageous journey to find his father, finally meeting the Minotaur in the labyrinth. While Theo, a modern-day teenage boy, finds himself on a maze-like quest to find his own father. Each story tells of a boy becoming a man and discovering what true manhood really means. The audio version of The Boy Lost in the Maze is read by Joseph Coilhole himself.
I'm doodling again. Geometric patterns and swirls. Sir doesn't mind. He lets me doodle. Knows it helps me think. Sir is silent again. He does this thing when he forgets words, presses thumb and forefinger to the bridge of his nose and massages, like memory is a small furry thing behind the eyes that needs coaxing. He massages and ignores our word offerings until memory squeals to his stroking. Manhood. Theseus's story is about manhood, about fathers and sons, about nature and nurture, about legacy and destiny, about parents and their children, and what it means to be a man. I nearly say something before remembering the happy family kids around me, the two parent kids, big house in Putney kids, been on a plane kids, have the full sky package kids. I rest my head back on my arms and listen to Sir tell Theseus's story. I scratch a poem title into my book. Theseus killed them.
Hi, I'm Joseph Coilhole, and my book, The Boy Lost in the Maze, is a story that combines two narratives, one of a modern-day teenager from London called Theo, and another narrative from ancient Greece, that of Theseus. Now, you might know Theseus from Theseus and the Minotaur, but in this novel, we pick up his story before his six labours, where he goes on a journey to meet his father. Both of these boys are going on journeys to meet their fathers, and their tales intertwine over time and space.
Your father is a king, said his mother. Just lift this heavy rock. He left some things for you to prove your kingly stock. Beneath the rock he found sandals and a sword, sandals for a journey, a sword for the criminal hordes. Theseus walked his father's road, but the way was filled with tests. He had to battle six enemies and prove he was the best. The first was Periphetes, who was a little dim. Theseus took his bronze club. Theseus killed him. The second was Sinis, who killed with a bent tree limb. He ripped his victims in two. Theseus killed him. The third was a pig, who'd been causing quite a stir. She was the Crominian, so Theseus killed her. The fourth was named Ceron, who gave his victims a surprise swim. He'd feed them to a monster turtle. Theseus killed him. The fifth was Cercimon, a king who wrestled for a whim. He'd wrestle strangers to death. Theseus killed him. The sixth was innkeeper Procrustes, who liked everything to be trim, forcing guests to fit his bed. Theseus killed him. When the killing journey was done, Theseus found his father's kingdom grim, the young yearly killed by the Minotaur, so Theseus killed him.
It shares a lot of DNA with the girl who became a tree, not only in the illustrations, but it's a story told in poems, and it's also, the first book was also inspired by Daphne and Apollo. Do you think the themes in ancient Greek myth are still relevant today?
Absolutely. I feel, you know, these stories have truly, you know, stood the test of time because they are universal. They sort of speak to something primal and archetypal. Yeah, I think Greek myths in general, legends, fairy tales, you know, at their very heart, they have these archetypal characters, you know, the hero, the heroine, the villain. And through telling these stories and reinterpreting them, we end up exploring some of the big questions, you know, life and death. Morals, you know, are often explored in these tales. So I think they are completely timeless.
And also, like the girl who became a tree and overheard in a tower block, is a story told in poems. Do you think this one's getting closer to being a whole verse novel?
Yeah, well, I was really interested in exploring how far you could push narrative, but through individual poems. So that's why, you know, overheard in a tower block and the girl who became a tree, I sort of preface it by saying these are stories told in poems, which I think is slightly different to verse novels, which are using more of a prosaic verse form to tell a narrative, which that medium does excellently. But I was really interested in seeing how I could use a mix of formed, structured poems and freeform poetry to tell a story. So I think this one is definitely the veering more towards that verse novel end. But I was very much wanted to keep on using structured poems and mixing it up with freeform poetry.
Now, you mentioned the word structured. Does the metaphorical maze or labyrinth have anything to do with the structure of the book?
Yeah. So as you make your way through the novel, there are chapters that end with a choose-your-own-adventure element. I loved the choose-your-own-adventure stories when I was a kid. I would borrow them all the time from my local library. And if you're not aware of choose-your-own-adventures, basically when you get to the end of a chapter, there's a choice where you can, you know, you decide whether the character goes, for example, left or right. And if you go left, then you're instructed to go to page XX. If you go right, you go to page YY. And through that, in that way, you make your way through the novel. And I was really interested in using this technique because it mirrors a maze. You know, you hit dead ends by using the choose your own adventure format, and you have to really work to navigate your way through the labyrinth of the book.
Now, you're the children's laureate. How long is left in your laureateship?
Just under 2 months now. So yeah, in July I'll be handing over. So it's been a roller coaster of 2 years. Well, for me, it's been a bit longer than 2 years because, of course, I knew for quite a while before I was announced as the laureate, and there was a lot of planning happening in the background. So I've got a lot of writing to catch up on, and sort of looking forward to reflecting on my time as laureate and seeing what the future holds.
So tell us about the poetry prompt.
Oh, yeah, the poetry prompts was one of the kind of cornerstones of my tenure. Before I was published, I spent years working in schools as a creative writing practitioner, as a performance poet, as an unpublished performance poet, getting kids engaged with poetry through spoken word. And time again, teachers would tell me how they weren't sure what to do with poetry, needed more help with poetry. And so I really wanted to create a resource that was free to use, that teachers could just switch on and kind of forget about. So the poetry prompts are a series of videos that go live every Monday morning. At the moment, I think there's about 72 videos, or maybe 75. By the end of my tenure, there will be 80 videos free to use live on the Book Trust website, booktrust.org.uk/poetryprompts, and also available for free on my YouTube channel. And these videos are about 5 minutes long. And in each one, I show young people a fun, easy way to write a poem. And if students and teachers or parents want to take those activities further, on the Book Trust website, you can also download a free resource which ties that activity into the curriculum. And these resources have been created by the wonderful Charlotte Hacking, who's based at the Centre for Literacy in Primary Education, a wonderful organisation who have such a pedigree in creating resources for schools. So there's options there to take these activities further. And I really designed the poetry prompts so that they could be turned on during registration. So kids could be writing a poem during registration, or say, you know, a teacher has finished a scheme of work and you've got 10 minutes before play, then you can switch a video on, get the kids involved in some creative writing and really sort of sneak it into the school day.
I promise we will get back to the book in a second, but just when we're talking about school, this is going back a bit, but I had teachers who would say, that's not a real book, you know, if you're reading a comic. Do you think it matters what you're reading as long as you are reading?
No, I think what matters is passion. I think we really, as adults, we really take it for granted that we get to choose what we read. And I think that can sometimes be forgotten with young people. You know, often the approach is to tell young people what to read and to give them books that are good for them. And I think that whole process becomes a lot easier if you start with their passions. What are they interested in? Are they interested in football? Okay, well then you can get them onto Vanessa Taylor's football series, The Baller Boys. You know, are they interested in comics and graphic novels? Well then Sheena Dempsey's got a wonderful middle grade illustrated series, like comic book series, called Pablo and Splash. So if you work from their interests, it becomes so much easier to then introduce, when they're ready, if they want, other titles, other books which they might or may not be interested in. But I think passion is key.
Out of interest, do you know who's taking over the laureateship after you, or is that a closely guarded secret?
It's a closely guarded secret, so I couldn't possibly say. But all will be revealed in July at the a big announcement and a handover.
Now, getting back to the boy lost in the maze, he's searching for a missing father, but that's also a search for not the self, but a missing part of the self, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely wanted to explore masculinity and toxic masculinity, especially through this book, and what it means to be a man, which ultimately, you know, is what it means to be a person, you know, how society tells us how we should behave and what that actually means for the individual. So, you know, Theseus heads out looking for his father, believing he can only show up at his father's doorstep, having proven himself a quote unquote man, which, you know, in those times meant defeating villains and monsters. And, you know, in the original Greek myth, in the original six labors of Theseus, he basically goes and meets villains and monsters and kills them. And that's it. You know, he'll meet this person, they're bad, he kills them. So I wanted to add a nuance to that. I wanted to really dive deep into what were these meetings actually like? Did he simply kill them? And I had a lot of fun reinterpreting that myth, but also blending it with Theo's story, where he's going on a search through modern day London and he's meeting characters that have a certain synergy with the monsters and villains that Theseus meets, but obviously not exactly the same. They're the sort of modern London equivalent. But through that process, he is discovering himself, discovering what it means for him to be a man, discovering a new relationship with a biological father that he didn't know. So yeah, it certainly is a discovery of self, as well as an actual search for a father.
We have to choose a subject for our English coursework. I choose to write about Theseus. Everything is just about him and the Minotaur. I choose to delve into his journey to his father. I choose to start reading everything I can about him. Everything is all about the bull. Everything is all about the minotaur. Everything is all about muscle and horns. Everything is about bestial strength, blood and bones. I choose to make my coursework a series of poems about his search for his father.
Now, you read the audio version of The Boy Lost in the Maze. I take it that's sort of second nature to you to read them out loud.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my background was in performance poetry. And so I love bringing words to life through performance. And I've been very fortunate in that I've been able to do the audio recordings for all my audio books, from picture books to middle grade books and now YA. But yeah, I feel like words come to life when they are read aloud. And I think there's lots of different ways of doing that, you know, be it in performance or, you know, in front of a classroom or in an assembly or indeed up on a stage. But it can also just be between two people at home, between a parent and a child, or, you know, between family members or friends. I think as adults, we often feel that, oh, you can only, you know, really it's something to be done between an adult and a child. But actually, at all ages, adults can read to each other. Myself and my partners, we sometimes read to each other out loud, and it's just a lovely experience. So if anyone hasn't done that of late, I would highly recommend it.
Now, it's available in audio and also Braille from RNIB Library. Is that important to you that it's now accessible to everyone who may have sight loss or a print disability?
Yeah, absolutely. I think as writers, you want your work to be as widely available as possible, because that's what writing is about. It's about connection, about bringing people together. And so the more people that have access, the better. So I, of course, welcome that. And hope to see as many of my books available in as many formats as possible.
But one thing we'll miss, though, if we access the Braille or the audio versions, is the cover. Can you tell us about the cover and Theo's great T-shirt?
So the cover features Theo, who is a young black teenager with a sort of closely shaved head. He is standing wearing jeans and like a tank top T-shirt, which has a bull or the Minotaur on the front of his T-shirt. These illustrations are by the wonderful Kate Milner, who's got a very sort of bold artistic style. So there's a lot of movement in her pictures. And so Theo kind of dramatically has his hand up on his forehead and one hand thrust into the pocket of his jeans. And we get the profile of his face and there's kind of shading across his body and a big pink splurge behind his head and a maze as well, the sort of a suggestion of a maze behind him.
I've noticed a silence whenever I ask about my father. Unspoken whisperings mumble behind my mother's sealed lips.
The Boy Lost in the Maze is available in print, as an ebook, and in audio as read by Joseph Coilho commercially. It's also available in Braille and audio from RNIB Talking Books. And Joseph, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robert. It's been lovely.
Now, on today's show, let's go back to 2015, when Tanya Lanman won for her book, Buffalo Soldier.
All I got from her was a name, Charlotte. Darn fool fancy thing for a slave girl. Didn't no one never call me that.
The book concerns a young woman called Charlotte O'Hara. She's a slave in the American Deep South. During the Civil War, she's actually freed along with all the other slaves. But when they were freed, they discovered that, you know, there was really nothing for them. There were no jobs. The whole of the South had been turned upside down during the course of the war. And actually, a lot of the men ended up signing up for the army. So actually, Charlotte O'Hara in this book finds she's in such a desperate situation that she actually disguises herself as a man and signs up for the US Army. But then she discovers that she thinks it's going to be peace. But actually, she is then sent out into the American West to fight in what the Americans called the Indian Wars. So, and it's actually based on a true story. I found when I was researching for a different book, I came across a reference to a real woman who was called Kathy Williams, who had been in exactly that situation. She was a slave. She was freed in the war and had then disguised herself. And she'd actually got away with it for 2-3 years. So it is all actually inspired by a true story.
Now, the other novel you mentioned there is obviously Apache. Is this sort of on the flip side of Apache?
It's kind of linked to it. I mean, Apache, I wanted to write from the point of view of the Native Americans, because when I was growing up, I always watched Westerns that they were always told from the kind of cowboys and the settlers' point of view. And it was when I was doing the research for Apache that I came across references to the Buffalo Soldiers. So it very much kind of grew out of that. But it was like the Buffalo Soldiers were the sort of missing piece of the puzzle, if you like, that I kind of had on one side the Native Americans and on the other side the white settlers who were moving into the American West. And I didn't realise until I was researching Apache that there was this kind of third group of people who were out there. And that was the guys who had been slaves. And it's a massive chunk of American history that was kind of missing from my knowledge of it, because it doesn't really get very much talked about. So that was why I ended up writing the book.
And what influence does Pocahontas have?
Oh, Pocahontas. Well, I grew up in Gravesend in Kent, which is just kind of downriver from London. And that's actually, you know, that Gravesend hasn't got many claims to fame, but one of its claims to fame is that it's where the real Pocahontas died and was buried. She was actually going back to America, I believe, but she became ill with a fever and then died in Gravesend. And I don't think they know exactly where she was buried, but there is a statue to her. And when I was growing up as a child, that statue was just kind of standing there, and it was she was just kind of outlined against this great grey expanse of Thames. I mean, I think they've built a shopping centre behind her now. But when I was growing up, it was just this beautiful statue of this Native American girl just sort of standing there with her hands outstretched. And she looked so out of place against, you know, this massive expanse of the Thames and then Tilbury Docks in the far distance. And that image really haunted me when I was a child. It really kind of got deep into my subconscious, I think. So, yeah, Pocahontas was probably the start of all of that. And again, you know, it was that image, that very sad image of the girl, was so at odds with the kind of Westerns that I grew up with, where, you know, the Native Americans were always depicted as being these kind of savage warriors. And so I think that's probably why it jarred in my head.
Well, the Disney version of that story is quite anodyne. Did you feel a need to tell a kind of real raw version?
Certainly. I felt when I was doing Apache, I really felt I needed to, you know, tell the other side of the story, actually for me, really, because I'd been brought up believing cowboys were goodies, you know, and the settlers were the goodies and the Native Americans were the baddies. And I was really writing to tell myself the story that I feel I should have been told as a child.
Now, you've obviously done an awful lot of research for these books. Where does the line between historian and novelist lie?
Well, I always say that it's what I'm writing is historical fiction. You know, I am not writing a textbook. So I do a lot of research because I want to have the kind of sound and the smells and the scenery all kind of embedded in my head. But there does come a point at which you close the books and you step away from it and you need to let your imagination take over. And the most important thing to do is to tell a really gripping story. So, you know, there are at some times that, you know, you have a kind of choice between you're going to stick with absolute historical accuracy or are you going to go with the gripping story? And I always go with the gripping story because I'm writing fiction, you know, otherwise I would be writing textbooks.
And that fiction won the Philip Carnegie Medal. How did that feel?
Oh, absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. No, I mean, Buffalo Soldier took me kind of 5 years to write on and off. It was a really big, big, big project. And of course, a lot of that time, you're just there on your own, in your room, you know, and being kind of plagued by self-doubt and, you know, all the kind of things that novelists get played with. So then when the book's actually out, you know, and then people start reading it and liking it and talking about it, you know, that's amazing. And then when it gets shortlisted for a prize like the Carnegie, that's even more amazing. And then actually winning it was just kind of beyond belief, really. I still don't think it's sunk in. I still kind of keep waking up thinking, oh, God, I don't believe it. And it was just a magic day as well. I mean, it was a really... yeah, fantastic. I'm getting quite emotional even talking about it, actually. I get a bit Kate Winslet talking about it.
Now, the part of a Carnegie medal is the shadowing scheme. What's it like reading the comments on the shadowing part of the Carnegie website?
Oh, I absolutely love it. I love the whole shadowing process. You know, it's so nice. I mean, I was doing kind of Skype interviews and school visits and all of that right the way through. And I love the shadowing groups because they are so passionate and so energetic and intelligent and, you know, fantastic buzzy groups to talk to. And I love the shadowing site as well. I mean, I was absolutely kind of addicted to that, reading it. And again, for the same reason, because you've got, you know, even when they don't like the book, you know, and you know, I got a fair few that were, you know, sort of negative reviews of it. But it's students that are really engaged with the whole kind of process of reading and discussing and thinking. And that is just, you know, incredibly refreshing and wonderful for a writer. So, I was kind of visiting that site several times a day.
Now, I've heard you say it's hard to read your book out loud because your voice isn't the character's voice.
Yeah.
How does that feel when an audio version's made?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one for me because... you know, obviously when I go out and do school events and sort of, you know, very often people like to have a reading, and it's one that I don't really, I don't actually read from it apart from the first section, which kind of, you know, isn't necessarily in Charlie's voice. Mm. But, you know, I didn't have any problem with writing it. It's the funny, because I could hear that voice very, very clearly in my head, but obviously I can't sort of mimic it.
My life began in the cookhouse. Seemed I'd just grown there, like a seed from a crack in the floor. Child's heart got to attach itself to something. Mine attached itself to Cookie, winding around her like bindweed on a post. So long as she was there, I could stand tall. When she was gone, I was left sprawling on the ground, helpless, twisting and twining every which way, not knowing how I was ever going to get up on my own 2 feet.
Now, I believe during the award ceremony, you were presented with a Braille version of the book.
I was, yes. But that was fantastic. I mean, that was such a wonderful moment. And that was really lovely meeting the group as well that brought those along. I mean, like I say, it was just a really brilliant day all round. It was fantastic.
How important is it that your works are available in Braille and in audio and accessible to everyone?
Oh, well, I mean, I'm totally about accessibility, you know, I mean, it's incredibly important, I think. You know, in a way, it's a shame the whole of the long list didn't kind of... done as well. You know, I just think all of this stuff needs to be available for everybody all the time. You know, it's why I'm such a huge supporter of libraries as well. You know, you don't want people's access to books to be limited. So I think that's a wonderful, wonderful aspect to it.
Me and Cookie was the property of Mr. Delaney. His plantation was 3 miles outside of town, but it could have been 3,000. Until the war came, I never set one foot off the place. My world was the cookhouse, the attic above it, the bare earth yard around it, the vegetable garden beyond it. That was all. I never got as far as the fields even. My only aims in life was pleasing Cookie, not getting noticed by the master, and avoiding Jonas Beecher.
Laurel Lefkoe reading the Philip Carnegie Medal winning book, Buffalo Soldier. Available in print wherever books are sold and from RNIB Library in Braille and in audio. For more information, head to rnib.org.uk.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
And now a return to Manon and Stephen Ross for the books of our life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Yes. To be honest, there are so many. I won't list them here. But I think my favourite book of all time has to be Boy by Roald Dahl. I love that book so much. And I think I've read that book once a year. When the seasons change from summer to autumn, I always read Boy. So that means that I've read it for sort of 30 years running, something like that. I just think the descriptions are so beautiful, and it's a quiet book stylistically. There's no big shouting. There's just something so beautiful and touching about it. I absolutely love Boy.
These were words of doom. A stripe. I'm giving you a stripe. All around, I could feel a kind of sympathy reaching out to me from every boy in the school, but nobody moved or made a sound. Here I must explain the system of stars and stripes that we had at St. Peter's. For exceptionally good work, you could be awarded a quarter star, and a red dot was made with crayon beside your name on the notice board. If you got 4 quarter stars, a red line was drawn through the 4 dots, indicating that you had completed your star. For exceptionally poor work, or bad behaviour, you were given a stripe, and that automatically meant a thrashing from the headmaster. Every master had a book of quarter stars and a book of stripes, and these had to be filled in and signed and torn out exactly like cheques from a chequebook. The quarter stars were pink, the stripes were a fiendish blue-green colour. The boy who received a star, or a stripe, would pocket it until the following morning after prayers, when the headmaster would call upon anyone who had been given one or the other to come forward in front of the whole school and hand it in. Stripes were considered so dreadful that they were not given very often. In any one week it was unusual for more than 2 or 3 boys to receive stripes. And now Captain Hardcastle was giving one to me.
The RNIB version of Boy by Roald Dahl is narrated by Ian Craig and lasts for 4 hours. Is there a book on a rainy day you go back to again and again to reread?
I love the work of John Wyndham. And this is quite a recent thing. I think about 5 or 6 years ago, I started reading John Wyndham, and I started with The Kraken Wakes, which is a wonderful, wonderful novel. But I think my favourite is The Day of the Triffids. And I'd always heard about it, and I think I'd seen stills from films made, and it just looked insane. You know, there's just kind of plants eating people and all that kind of thing. And I thought, that's not my kind of sci-fi. And then I read the book, and it's just so wonderful. That's the kind of thing that I'd like to be able to write, which is sci-fi, but it's about the human experience of it. It's about the relationships. It's something just, I can't put any of Wyndham's books down. They're just wonderful. So beautifully done, so cleverly done.
The way I came to miss the end of the world, well, the end of the world I had known for close on 30 years, was sheer accident. Like a lot of survival, when you come to think of it. In the nature of things, a good many somebodies are always in hospital, and the law of averages had picked on me to be one of them a week or so before. It might just as easily have been the week before that, in which case I'd not be writing now. I'd not be here at all. But chance played it not only that I should be in hospital at that particular time, but that my eyes, and indeed my whole head, should be wreathed in bandages. And that's why I have to be grateful to whoever orders these averages.
Yes, I don't know when this came out, but I've just finished reading it, and it's called The Hidden Life of Trees by Peter Woolaben, and it's a factual book about trees, and it's research, basically. I'm doing a little bit of research on something that I'm thinking about writing about, and I thought, oh, this could be quite dull and heavy and scientific, and I'm not great with that kind of thing, but actually it's really accessible. It's about the relationships that trees have to one another and how they exist within their spaces. It's not dry at all, and it's really made me appreciate trees even more. So yeah, that's a great read.
Creatures with such a luxury of time on their hands can afford to take things at a leisurely pace. The electrical impulses that pass through the roots of trees, for example, move at the slow rate of 1/3 of an inch per second. But why, you might ask, do trees pass electrical impulses through their tissues at all? The answer is that trees need to communicate, and electrical impulses are just one of their many means of communication. Trees also use the senses of smell and taste for communication. If a giraffe starts eating an African acacia, the tree releases a chemical into the air that signals that a threat is at hand. As the chemical drifts through the air and reaches other trees, they smell it and are warned of the danger. Even before the giraffe reaches them, they begin producing toxic chemicals. Insect pests are dealt with slightly differently. The saliva of leaf-eating insects can be tasted by the leaf being eaten. In response, the tree sends out a chemical signal that attracts predators that feed on that particular leaf-eating insect. Life in the slow lane is clearly not always dull.
The Hidden Life of Trees by Peter Woolaben is available from RNIB Talking Books. It's read by Mike Grady and lasts for 7 hours, 44 minutes. And once again, Maren Stephen Ross, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robert.
That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, there are over 400 episodes available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.